This is the Inland Journal from Spokane Public Radio. I'm Doug Nadvornik. We're going to spend the whole program talking about the treatment of opioid addiction in the Inland Northwest. According to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, more than 15,000 Americans died in 2015 after overdosing on opioids. Opioids are substances, both natural and man-made, that relieve pain. Deaths from heroin have risen steadily between 2010 and 2015. Deaths from synthetic opioids such as fentanyl increased significantly from 2013 to 2015. At the state level in Washington, 718 people died from opioid overdoses in 2015, that according to the state attorney general's office. That's more people than died from car accidents in the state that year. In Spokane County, the medical examiner's office says 63 people died of drug-related deaths during the first half of 2016. States like West Virginia, New Hampshire, and Ohio have some of the highest rates of opioid-related deaths in the nation. But Dr. Matt Layton says Spokane has significant issues as well. Layton is the medical director for the Spokane Regional Health District's Opioid Treatment Program.
I would say when you look at overdose deaths that we do have that same problem, the same degree of problem. Our heroin overdose deaths are going up dramatically, and those are in line with the other parts of the country that are facing that same aspect of the opioid epidemic. I think what's interesting is to look at the environment of those states that have had a lot of these issues. So, for example, you can look at Oklahoma and Kentucky and West Virginia, and those areas are traditionally known for less alcohol consumption. But what's interesting is that they're higher in terms of their opioid consumption. And there's a lot that has to do with the moral judgment around being prescribed a medication and it being okay, as opposed to alcohol being more of a moral judgment.
Why are the heroin numbers going up?
The issue is that heroin can be obtained cheaply, and it is plentiful. And so people who begin by getting addicted to pain medications often run out of money, and they're not able to afford those anymore. And they go to the streets to the cheaper alternative, which is heroin. You don't know how pure it's going to be. It creates many other health consequences by going down that path.
More on that later in the program. There's a lot going on to address opioid misuse at the local, state, and federal levels. In 2 weeks, Washington Attorney General Bob Ferguson will convene a two-day meeting in Seattle. He's invited police officers, medical professionals, prosecutors, and public health experts to share best practices in opioid management. And 2 weeks ago, Washington Governor Jay Inslee signed into law an update to the state regulations for opioid treatment. The bill passed by overwhelming votes in both chambers, suggesting strong bipartisan support for expanding and improving opioid treatment.
The state is moving towards a completely integrated payment structure, supposedly by 2020, to combine primary care, mental health, and addictive disorders, and to be able to treat those in one setting. The big challenge to doing that is it's been siloed in terms of funding so that the mental health disorders are paid over here and the addictions are paid over here and primary care is paid over here. And so the push from the governor's office is to say that the state legislature, the intent of the legislation was to remove those barriers and to make it easier for people to get treatment, for example, for mental disorder or addiction by going to their doctor. And rather than having to go to a separate chemical dependency agency or a separate mental health agency. But we've been doing it this way for a long time, and so there's still a lot of challenges towards achieving that integrated care model.
The Spokane Regional Health District's opioid treatment program has enrolled more than 900 people. Many of them visit the clinic several times a week.
The purpose of the opioid treatment program is to take people who have opioid use disorder and get them on medication-assisted treatment, which is the evidence-based approach for helping manage the opioid addiction. That's mainly methadone, which has been used for treating heroin addiction and other opioid addictions and studied for over 50 years. And now we're doing buprenorphine, which is also known as Suboxone, which is a newer version, but it's also an evidence-based treatment in the harm reduction mode, which means we're going to provide a medication to treat the disease as opposed to expect them to be completely abstinent.
You talk about evidence-based treatment. Tell me about the other approaches that are used in other parts of the country.
Abstinence only is the ideal if somebody can stop using substances or drinking alcohol and get healthy, get recovery, and go on about their lives. The unfortunate thing about opioids is that they're a different kind of animal, and the relapse rate is upwards of 90% in 9 months from trying to stop without medication assisted. So we feel like that the harm reduction model takes somebody who has a lifestyle that has them using street drugs, they're in out of jail, they're often homeless and in and out of the emergency rooms, and we stabilize them on a daily dose of an opioid that is more of a treatment.
So before we get to that, why are these opioids so powerful?
They dramatically change the brain structure, the physiology. We have natural chemicals in our body that are known as endorphins or enkephalins that bind these opioid receptors in the brain. A lot of people know those as runner's high or the euphoria that you get from working out. But it's basic things like eating and sleeping and playing with your kids. All those things release natural opioids that make us feel good about life. When somebody has started overusing and exposing their brain to high doses of opioids from external, whether it's prescription pain medications or heroin or anything else, that actually changes the physiology in the brain and how the brain reacts when you take away that substance. When you take away that substance, you now have withdrawal, which feels like people just describe it as the flu on steroids. They feel sick, and they will do things that they never thought they would. They'll lie, they'll cheat, and they'll steal to get a fix just to feel well.
So why is it that so many people can take opioids? My wife took some after a knee replacement last year, and they're just fine. Why is it that certain people can't get past that?
We know a lot about the risk susceptibility genes and that addiction does run in families as well as other mental health disorders. Whether they're talking about depression or anxiety or even obsessive compulsive disorder, they tend to run along genetic lines in families. So what we see here at the clinic, and we're up to 930 patients now, so we have a sizable population, is that they usually present in either one of two ways. If they have had a family history of addiction, and they had their parents had addiction problems, their grandparents, aunts, uncles, and siblings, we literally have generations on the program because of that. They were never given a chance to have a normal brain to develop. On the other side, you have people who've been exposed to opioids after a car accident or a serious disease or illness, including cancer. Now, they have been exposed to opioids that were prescribed, but their brain can still be susceptible, and so they can respond differently from other people who are able to just have a few days, and then their pain is better, and they don't need them. These people tend to keep taking them, and then they become dependent on them.
So in terms of the generational thing, does it change the DNA then?
We're studying a lot. They're called epigenetic changes, and that is what happens to the DNA after the person is born. And so you have the gene makeup that you're given at birth, but then the things that you experience in life and your environment, we do know that it alters your DNA and that they can be transmitted and even beyond one generation. But that is an exciting area of new research that we need to learn a lot more about.
So tell me about the history of this program that you're the head of right now.
I'm the medical director, and thankfully we have Julie Albright, who's a program administrator, because there's so much that goes along with the medication. We have more than 10 chemical dependency counselors. We have nurses. We have dispensary assistants to help manage that. So the logistics are very challenging. In the 3 years that I've been medical director, we've gone from under 600 patients up to 930. So that'll tell you just how much of a problem we do have in Spokane and in this region, is because we have been bringing individuals in as quickly as we can create slots for them. The good news is we got an infusion of funding within the last year that allowed us to take about 150 people off of our waiting list, and we're bringing them into services.
What's the evidence that this program is doing good in the community?
I think that the main evidence for methadone in this community and in others is the reduction of illegal activities and recidivism, the in and out of jail, because the addiction is so powerful that people turn to crime in order to feed the addiction. And when you survey law enforcement agencies, and we put together a training with crisis intervention team here in Spokane where we talked about that, there are individuals who will share their stories that once they got stabilized on methadone, they have been able to pay their restitution. They've not been in jail for 6 years. They're free and clean from all of their warrants. And I think that's probably the most powerful thing. The other is the emergency department overutilization. And so when you see somebody get stabilized on methadone or buprenorphine, they stop that revolving door through the emergency department and doctor's offices and pharmacies because they're shopping around trying to get their needs met.
So how do people get enrolled in your program, and how does it work on a day-to-day basis?
The enrollment is that if you are experiencing opioid use disorder, you're eligible. The top of the list for access goes to pregnant women, and we probably have about 20 pregnant women in the program right now at any one time. It's the standard of care for treating a pregnant woman and the fetus during opioid use disorder. So that's the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology says methadone is the gold standard for that all the way through, and including breastfeeding, because so little the methadone gets into the breast milk. Then we go to IV drug users. So if someone is actively using intravenously, they are at risk for a number of different infectious diseases, such as hepatitis and HIV. And they also get abscesses and cellulitis and heart disease from intravenous drug use. So they're eligible to come into the program. And then anyone else who has an opioid use disorder, they go through an intake assessment that's required by the state, because we're a certified, credentialed opioid treatment program, and we are regulated at the county, state, and federal levels. So there's a lot of documentation of the patient's baseline characteristics and then treatment planning, and they have to have individualized service plans going forward.
Dr. Matt Layton says the Spokane treatment program was boosted by an infusion of money through the expansion of the low-income Medicaid program paid for through the Affordable Care Act. It allows the health district to see more Medicaid patients. With the possible removal of the ACA and potential cuts to Medicaid proposed by the Trump administration, it remains to be seen how the Spokane program would be affected. So I think we're also hearing about people who are not only buying, they're buying heroin not knowing if it's mixed with something. And we talk about the synthetic opioids like fentanyl and some of those other ones. Is there a way that people can do some sort of quality control checking on their heroin?
It would be similar to needle
exchange. I can't believe I'm asking this question.
This is a new thing. It's a new epidemic. And so we have to look for new solutions. And it's a lot like the needle exchange programs. You can look at Indiana as a good example. We now have Vice President Pence, when he was governor there, was strictly anti-needle syringe exchange programs until there was an outbreak of HIV in a small rural county, which was affecting young people. And suddenly at that point, when faced with the crisis, then Governor Pence decided that the syringe exchange program was preferable to having kids contracting HIV and dying. When we talk about safe shooting areas, where there are places where, if you're talking about the Netherlands or even some places in the U.S., are pushing for spots where IV drug users can go to actually consume the substance. And while that's not the same thing as the quality control, it's creating an environment that's happening in Vancouver, BC. There's a big push in Seattle. As far as I know, we don't have any of those in Spokane as of yet.
So what is that? I mean, we're getting to some big time moral issues. We're talking about political issues here. How has that changed over the last few years as you've been in this position?
I think that I will reflect on that from the standpoint of medical education and how do we educate our physicians to deal with this problem and our nurses and our pharmacists, the interprofessional medical education. And what I will say is that we are always talking about the evidence. Show me the evidence. Is this diagnosis real? Can we say this is really a diagnosis because it affects a population the same way, consistently? Perhaps it's really a syndrome. Then you can start to say, well, then what's the appropriate treatment for that? And how did we find that treatment? Was it done through randomized controlled placebo trials where we actually blind both the doctor or the researcher and the individual who's participating to make sure neither one knows who's getting the active treatment? And then we look at the results later and say, okay, did this treatment work for this disorder? And when it comes to opioid use disorder, we have to take responsibility as a medical profession that we have contributed to the problem by prescribing medications, often without a lot of monitoring, and letting them get down the road where somebody is taking a large quantity and they're having early refills and lost or stolen medications. And when they get to that point, and we hear about it, we just cut them off cold, and then they go to the street and have more problems. So what we're trying to do now is say up front, the evidence is that if we use these appropriately and with discretion for short duration, then they can be managed just like other high-risk prescribing practices. But we need to be aware that if we start to get into problems with our patients, it's the communication and the doctor-patient relationship that's going to get us out of that.
So you say short duration. There are some people who are going to take that the rest of their life. I mean, I've heard people say, you know, 6 days a week, I'm going to be taking methadone the rest of my life because I can't otherwise deal with that. Does that get pretty expensive if the government is paying for a lot of these drugs?
That's where the corrections officers and I see eye to eye, because they don't want to be building more prisons. And so that's the flip side, is if we spend money on treatment, then we know the Washington State Institute for Public Policy has estimated that we get over $3 in economic benefit for $1 of treatment. So if we can actually treat people, keep them out of the emergency departments, keep them out of other expensive institutions like prison, then I think you can really do a cost-benefit analysis.
And what's the state in our jail right now in terms of treating inmates? Is it expanding?
Yes, and I'm so happy that in January the Drug Enforcement Agency softened its restrictions. And so I can sit in my office in the health district, I can look over and see the county jail two blocks away, and we have just in the last couple of months been able to have our individuals, who often are stable, but then have to serve a warrant, go into jail. In the past, they wouldn't do that because they would go into withdrawal. The way it is now is we know who they are, we know when they're going in, we work closely with the jail medical staff, we have licensed nurses carrying pre-dispensed, pre-packaged, and labeled locked medicine over two blocks and handing it to the jail medical staff. And we're all relieved, because it just didn't do anybody any good for them to be avoiding serving their warrants or to be going in and then just suffering for days in withdrawal. So a lot of improvements there.
So do you worry that with the new administration, perhaps a change in approach or a change in emphasis, that this might change? Or do you think that this is going to be the wave of the future for the Spokane area?
I think that the evidence that this is a bipartisan issue is at the local level. And as we know, all politics is really local. And so when I was doing the crisis intervention team training the morning after the election, so it was November 9th, 2016, and what I started out talking to the law enforcement group about was that the Helping Families with Mental Health Crisis Act passed 422-2 in the House. That is as bipartisan as it gets. Two people will always vote against something, no matter what. But I was able to put that up on the board and say, when we put that together with the Comprehensive Addiction Recovery Act, CARA, and the Helping Families and Mental Health Crisis Act, that's a bipartisan issue. And then that resulted in the 21st Century Cures Act, which is going to be really difficult to undo because it helps this population.
And because Kathy McMorris-Rogers is one of the main proponents of that.
Yes.
One final topic in our conversation. At the federal level, the president's nominee to become Assistant Secretary for Mental Health and Substance Abuse is due to have her confirmation hearing soon. That's Dr. Eleanor McCants-Katz. She's a psychiatrist who would prioritize more aggressive treatment for patients with severe psychiatric disorders such as schizophrenia and perhaps more hospitalization for the mentally ill.
What I'm excited about is that the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, SAMHSA, is
The federal agency. That is the federal agency,
and they're really supposed to address both substance use and mental health concurrently. And in my experience, it seems to have been one or the other, again, in that siloed way. And so what I'm happy to hear her saying is we have a greater need for psychiatric capacity, which Washington State definitely needs. We're next to the bottom in terms of number of psychiatric beds per capita. She's also encouraging peer recovery and counseling. And so that's an area that's been underemphasized in parts of the community, but peer counseling and sponsoring have always been a part of addiction treatment. And so in a sense, we want to create an environment where people are learning the right things from their peers instead of the negative peer pressure. But then when things get so bad that people are in crisis and they need a higher level of care, we need the continuum of care.
Dr. Matt Layton is the medical director of the Spokane Regional Health District's Opioid Treatment Program. He's also a faculty member at the Washington State University College of Medicine. Next week on Inland Journal, we'll air an interview we had planned for this week. We'll talk with a Western Washington man who lost part of an arm in an industrial accident. And recently, he brought his message of workplace safety to high school students in Spokane.
We watch a little movie first, and then I talk in. A lot of times you go in there and it doesn't matter how rambunctious the teacher thinks it is. You could hear a pin drop. I mean, they hang on every word I say.
Inland Journal is our weekly public affairs program, heard every Thursday at 5 p.m. here on KSFC. You can listen online anytime at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Go to the Inland Journal page. I'm glad you joined us. I'm Doug Nadvornik.